Thanks for that, Derek. But if we could come back to the idea of our culture being an abusive relationship, I find that quite often, as activists, we take the victim mentality and really see ourselves as a victim of this culture. Can you speak about how we could think of ourselves as survivors of this culture?
Yeah, it's a great question. I have to think for a second. Can you ask that question again slightly differently?
I work in the violence against women sector, and I find that working with second wave feminists in an organization that's been around for 30 years, I'll quite often run into women who will say, "No, we shouldn't ask for that because we're victims. For whatever reason, we might not deserve it. We might not get it." And what in that specific organization and in my work as an activist, I'm thinking of ways that we can really stop viewing ourselves as victims and start viewing ourselves as powerful, strong survivors.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that actually leads to a discussion of hope, I think, which is one of my favorite things to bash. First, I think that before we see ourselves as not victims, but as survivors, I think first we do have to see ourselves as victims, because I think a lot of people are walking around not recognizing that they are victims. You know, in terms of battered women, it's like, well, you know, I'm not a victim of domestic violence. He just gets a little upset, and, you know, it's my fault. And I mean, so I really did bring it on. And so that person, I think, first has to go through a stage of recognizing, yes, I am being victimized by an exploiter. And we can see how that relates on the larger scale, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And don't worry, I'm not going to stop us there. But my point is that we have to recognize that the system is exploiting us and exploiting everyone around us. We have to recognize we are victims first. You can't stop there, because victims are fundamentally powerless. And the next step is to make a decision as to whether you want to be a victim or not. And well, actually, before that, you have to recognize that your victimhood is not inevitable, that there are other things you can do, that there are alternatives. Because that's one of the things that an abuser always does. One of the first things that an abuser does is monopolize the victim's perception. Because if you can monopolize the other person's perception, that's why so many abusers will destroy all the other relationships in a person's life, is because if the person has any inkling that there are other ways to be, if there's any inkling that escape is really possible, then the perpetrator will never be able to turn the person into a real victim, because a victim really is someone a victim, when it's totally internalized, is someone who no longer sees a way out. And so when I was saying a person has to recognize they're a victim, I'm being a little bit sloppy, because, okay, here's what I want to say. Instead of recognizing they are a victim, I should say the first thing is that they have to recognize they're being victimized. So are you more comfortable with that?
Mm-hmm. Or recognize the oppression that they're living under.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. And then once you recognize, but that's an inevitable first step, because if you don't recognize that you're living under oppression, then why would you want to escape anyway?
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing is to recognize you are being oppressed, and then the second thing is to recognize that there is a way, that there are ways out, and the perps will do anything they can to attempt to make that unthinkable. And so one of the first things we need to do is to recognize the possibilities of difference. I mean, in terms of a larger question, not every culture has killed the planet. That's, you know, it's not every, I mean, this is not a human problem. Not every human culture has acted this way. There were humans, as I said, living here for at least 12,500 years, and we can say the same thing for many, many, many different places. Humans have lived, I mean, the San Bushmen of who are now being eradicated, they evolved in place. I mean, they and their evolutionary predecessors lived there for like 3.5 billion, or not, I mean, for 3.5 million years, or for a couple million years. It's that is sustainable. And so we have to recognize first that other ways of living are possible, and second, we have to recognize that it's possible for us to defeat this culture. I read this horrible quote the other day by one of those sort of live simply gurus, who said that basically we're at a place now where we're at a place now where the Indians were in the late 19th century, where we have to recognize we can't win, and so we simply have to remember what it means to be human. And that made me so furious, because it's classic victim thinking. It's like, well, if I'm going to walk into the gas chambers, at least I can sort of hold my head up high as I do it, and that'll show them. It's like, that's nonsense, and that's horrible. And part of what we need to recognize is that we do actually have some power, and that we are able to affect change. And one of the things that we need to do for that is, one of the smartest things that the Nazis did was to make it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. And we can say the same thing. I'm going to stop and go a different direction for a second, because this all ties back in. And I've been advocating dam removal for years, and there are 60,000 dams in this country, in the United States, over 70,000 dams, I think, over 6 feet tall, 60,000 dams over 20 feet tall, about 2 million dams total. And yeah, dams being removed, but very, very slowly. And if we removed one dam per day, it would still take 200 years for us to take out all of the dams over 6 feet tall. And, you know, salmon and sturgeon don't have that long. And so I was, one of the arguments that's been used against taking out dams by some people is to say, you know, if you just take out a dam without, you know, going through all the proper channels, you cause more harm to the river than leaving the dam there. And I didn't know if that was true, so I called some fisheries biologists, and it was pretty funny, because I'd call up and say, hey, so if somebody takes out a dam, does that hurt the river? It's like, hello? Hello? You know, they wouldn't answer, of course, for obvious reasons. And so I said, well, let's change the framing a little bit and say, you know, this culture has collapsed, and no longer are the dams useful for economic purposes, blah, blah, blah. So people in your community ask you, is it better to let the dam wait until it fails or to take it out now? And they all then were happy to answer. And they also just basically the same thing, which is that, first, dams occur naturally. And this is going to come back. Don't worry, it'll apply. Dams occur naturally. And what doesn't occur naturally is for all the rivers to be dammed like this. But they do happen, you know, with mudslides or lava flows or ice jams or whatever. And then they break. And when they break, it's basically just a big flood. And rivers are not, we misunderstand rivers entirely, that rivers are not the things between the banks. Rivers, if you look at them over their lifetime, they writhe like snakes all over the landscape. They move everywhere. And all of that area is part of the river. And if every time a river changes course, it, and here's the point, every time a river changes course, every time there's a flood, that's, you know, it kills, you know, millions of insects and salamanders and frogs and fish and everything. But it causes short-term habitat loss, long-term habitat gain. That's what happens every time. And when somebody said that to me, it gave me chills. And the reason is, why do we stay in abusive relationships? Because we're afraid of short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. Why do we stay in jobs we hate? We're afraid of the short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. Why don't we bring down this culture? We're afraid of the short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. Why do we remain victims? We're afraid of short-term habitat loss for long-term habitat gain. It's central. It's absolutely central to everything. Now back to the Nazis. One of the smartest things the Nazis did was they co-opted rationality and co-opted hope by making it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? There's that short-term habitat loss. If I fight this, short-term habitat loss, long-term habitat gain. If, okay, Would you rather move to a ghetto? Would you rather resist and possibly get killed? You want to get on a cattle car? You want to resist and possibly get killed? You want to go into the showers? You want to resist and possibly get killed? But something very interesting is that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a much higher rate of survival than those who went along. I'll say that again. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a much higher rate of survival than those who went along. And so if we can get past that, okay, actually I want to talk about hope now very briefly, which is that years ago a friend of mine who's HIV positive sent me a bunch of literature on AIDS, and there was this one AIDS, and there was this one line that just slapped me in the face, which was eliminate false hope. And it seemed really crucial to me that that's one of the central things we have to do, is to eliminate false hope. What was it? I mean, one of the reasons my mother stayed with my father, who's incredibly violent, was because there weren't battered women shelters in the 50s and 60s. But another reason she stayed with him is because of the false hope that he would change. And does anybody really believe that Weyerhaeuser is going to stop deforesting because we asked nicely? Does anybody really believe that if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, things will be okay? Or that Monsanto will stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely? Those are all false hopes that keep us tied to the system. So we need to get rid of those. But it's not just false hope, it's hope itself. I was bashing hope at a talk I did a couple years ago, and someone in the audience shouted out, "So what do you mean by hope? What's your definition?" And I didn't have one, so I asked them to define it. And they came up with a definition that was really good, which is hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. So if I'm in an abusive relationship and I hope that I don't get beaten, that's, well, and I shouldn't say that, actually, because the truth is, it's back to the Nazi doctors thing, that women in abusive relationships oftentimes show tremendous, tremendous agency and ingenuity and brilliance in attempting to navigate that relationship without questioning the larger concentration camp Auschwitz abusive reality. So they can send the children over to the neighbors when they know that the father's going to get really abusive, or they can use sex to placate him to keep him from hitting them, or they can, you know, do this or do that. They can be incredibly resourceful, but without questioning that larger picture. But so far as the larger picture, and by the way, I don't want to blame the victims for not leaving too, because, or blame the women for not leaving, which they would still be victims if they don't leave, but I don't want to blame them for not leaving too, because we all know the statistics on that, that the average woman who finally leaves an abuser has already tried to leave like 7 times, and we all know the statistics on the women who get killed when they try to leave and all that. I'm not saying they should stay. I'm just saying I'm not attacking them for not leaving. That's why I want to be really clear on that. But anyway, back to the hope thing, is that hope is a longing for a future condition over which I have no agency. So if I say I hope that things improve, I'm saying I have no agency. If I say I hope that salmon don't go extinct, I'm saying I have no agency. On the other hand, I'm not going to say I hope I eat today. I'm just going to do it, you know? And it's the same. I don't hope that coho salmon survive and that Chinook salmon survive. I will do whatever it takes to make sure they survive. Salmon will not go extinct in my lifetime because I won't allow it. I will do whatever it takes to make sure they survive. And that's an incredibly different statement. That is a statement of a survivor. That is a statement of an actor, of someone who is being active. That's not the statement of a victim. And so one of the things I think is really important is to get to the state where a person says, I will do whatever it takes to stop this oppression. And that's not a process that happens over 5 minutes. I mean, you can say it, and then the next time you get beaten down, it's like, you know, and you can still respond the same way. I mean, I still fall back into old patterns, too. I mean, we need to really be forgiving of ourselves in that. I mean, it's not some magical pill that you take and suddenly you're invincible. But it's recognizing that once you give up on that identity as someone who relies on the abuser, once you realize that you don't need to rely on them and that you can fight back, something shifts dramatically.
So one person asked you, Derek, what keeps you fighting for change? How do you keep yourself from breaking down given all the horrifying realities of civilization? How do you think we can make our struggles more sustainable?
Oh, I break down all the time. I cry a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're not going to cry about the salmon, you know, what is there that's worth crying about? But I don't get burned out. I don't get burned out at all. And one of the reasons, that's part of it too. Is there's a lot of times there's this belief that if we really recognize how bad things are, that we have to be unhappy all the time. And the truth is, I'm really, really happy. I'm so in love with my life, and I'm so in love with life in general. We're all complex enough beings that we can hold in our hearts the understanding of how bad things are, and that life is really, really good. Life is so wonderful. I'm looking out the window here at these beautiful redwood trees, and life is just so wonderful, and that's one of the things that keeps me going. And there was a two-part question. What was the first part again?
What keeps you fighting for change?
Well, and that because I'm in love. You know, it's. I got this email from this guy in Washington a few years ago who said that he didn't know. He said his son's 15 years old and is really active and all, you know, great and everything. And he's really concerned because he doesn't know how to. He wants his son to keep fighting these fights, but he doesn't know how to give him hope. And I wrote back and said, if you want your son to keep fighting, don't give him hope. Give him love. Because if he loves, he'll keep fighting. You know, if you're in love, you act to defend your beloved. There's this strange notion somehow that love somehow, I mean, that the pacifists have sort of co-opted love, and that's just nonsense. I don't think that Mother Grizzly Bears would agree that if you love, you're a pacifist. You know, I grew up in the country, and in my life, I've been attacked by mother chickens, geese, ducks, horses, cows, mice, hummingbirds, hawks, eagles, spiders, who thought I was attacking their babies. And, you know, if a mother mouse is going to take on someone 6,000 times her size to defend those she loves, you know, what's wrong with us? So that's one of the things that keeps me going. There's a tremendous... Also, I don't try to fight the rage or the sorrow. I simply feel them. I am so full of rage, and I'm so full of love, and I'm so full of hate, and I'm so full of sorrow and joy and all those things. And it takes more energy to try to fight them down, to think they're bad, than it does to actually feel them and act on them. And they're wonderful things. I mean, if you're not going to get outraged at... I love the word outrage, you know, rage out, you know? And if you're not going to get outraged at the killing of the planet, you know, what is it going to take? It's so... Oh, I want to say one more thing about burnout, too, which is, you know, a lot of activists, I've known a lot of activists who've gotten burned out, and I think part of the reason is because we keep doing the same thing over and over again, and it keeps not working. And I think burnout is actually a really good piece of information because it's telling you this isn't working, so try something else. It's not telling you quit, because so many people, oh, God, I'm so burned out, I need to take a couple weeks off. And then they take a couple weeks off, and they come back, and they do the same stinking thing over again. And it's like, well, no wonder. But it might be, it's time to change some tactics and to figure out what will work and to try to just think clearly, what is it you want? Like I said, you know, I want more wild salmon. I mean, make that, you know, we can say the same thing. I have a good friend who runs the Bad Women's Program for the state of New York, Charlotte Watson, and... She's very clear on what she wants. She wants to live in a world where men don't beat on women. And, you know, so it doesn't matter whether you choose salmon or men beat on women or Ward Churchill has said he's really clear on what he wants. He wants a world where the dominant culture is not killing Indian children. And I was sharing the stage with him, and I was saying, you know, salmon children, he was saying Indian children, and we're like, yeah, it's the same battle. It doesn't matter. And so, you know, find out what you want and figure out how am I going to get there. And then just go for it. Just do it.